This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian and scholar in residence at Suffolk University, James Carroll, speaking with us today about the holy city of Jerusalem and the geopolitics of sacred violence. Your new book, Jim, comes with a subtitle, How the Ancient City Ignited Our Modern World, and the ignition you ascribe to the existence of two Jerusalems, the earthly and the heavenly, the actual city and the apocalyptic fantasies that it inspires. Why do you say that Jerusalem is the magnetic pole of Western history?
The most important reason is because the biblical experience of Jerusalem spawned in Christians a particularly apocalyptic fantasy attached to the city, spawned, by the way, in the savage violence of the Roman War, and that violence found its way into the Christian imagination. And the result is that down through the millennia, Christians looked back at Jerusalem as the ideal and the image of what the world would be like when the Messiah returned and the great era of peace and salvation began. The trouble was, in order for that era to come into being, Jerusalem had to be destroyed, and with it, all of those who were not on God's side. So I attached to Jerusalem this bipolar notion of the world divided between good and evil, and people who think of themselves only as good can wreck themselves terrible evils in the world. And Jerusalem has been a key to that core note of the Western imagination.
And the Jerusalem that the Christians had in mind was, of course, an imaginary place, not the city on the ridge between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea.
It's true, because, of course, they lost that first to the Romans and then, after some centuries, to the Muslims. The imagined Jerusalem is the Jerusalem of Christian preoccupation. Europe came into being during those almost 300 years of the Crusades in relationship to the fantasy of a reconquered Jerusalem, and it didn't happen. And what that led to was Europeans, even into the modern era, understanding themselves an inch below the surface in relationship to this city. Therefore, it was the most natural thing in the world for John Winthrop to invoke Jerusalem, the city on a hill, when he defined for his fellow Puritans what their ambition in the New World was. And they immediately named their settlement as they stepped from the Arbella, Salem, which is, of course, another name for Jerusalem. So even in America, we find an inch below the surface this notion of Jerusalem, a heavenly vision, but also one that has, down through the centuries, been heavily armed.
It's also the vision that Christopher Columbus had in mind.
Oddly enough, Lewis, astonishing in my to me when I discovered this, that Columbus, yes, he was motivated by looking for a path to the Indies, so-called. Yes, a quest for riches, gold, silver, yes. But when you read his chronicles and his reports to the King and Queen of Spain, he emphasizes his purpose as looking for a new route to Jerusalem because, of course, Jerusalem to the east was blocked by the Muslims. A journey to the west, he thought, would enable Europe finally to recover the holy city of Jerusalem, which was a millennial ambition. That is to say, bring about the hoped-for age of peace, the returned Messiah, the converted Jews, the triumph over infidels. So Columbus had a cosmic vision. It was apocalyptic. It was millennial. And lo and behold, it did, in fact, carry this, let's call it the virus of Jerusalem fever, across the Atlantic to the New World. And as I just said, the Puritans picked it up.
So much for the Christian imagined Jerusalem. What is the imagined Jerusalem to the Hebrews and to the Muslims?
This entire frame of reference begins, of course, when the Hebrews are kidnapped away from Jerusalem in the 6th century BCE by the Babylonians, a well-known story. All of our listeners know it. But what we don't really sufficiently appreciate is that it was looking back at Jerusalem that the Hebrews came into themselves as a people. What we call the religion of Judaism began there, and it began around the great insight attached to Jerusalem that God is one, and also that God cannot be known. So when they returned to Jerusalem, the Holy of Holies of their rebuilt temple was vacant, a perfect symbol of the unknowability of God and the oneness of God. They come back to Jerusalem, begin the ordering of their texts, and what do they put first? This Genesis idea that God is not the God of the tribe, not the God of our neighborhood, but the God of the entire cosmos, which means that all human beings are brothers and sisters under this God, a principle of peace. So for Hebrews, that first exile from Jerusalem generated a profound religious breakthrough. And then it happened again when the Romans and then Christians drive Jews into exile from Jerusalem. They look back longingly at Jerusalem. Next year in Jerusalem, they say every year. And that remembrance of Jerusalem, the imagined city once again, enabled Jews to maintain their cohesion as a people, always looking toward the return to the Jewish homeland, which took place in some almost literal way in 1948, which is the power for Jews, as I understand it, of the establishment of the State of Israel.
And now the imagined city in the mind of the Muslim.
The striking thing about those early Muslims is that their very first religious impulse turned them toward Jerusalem. Muhammad himself, when he, we don't know how, but he, a religious genius, has his own experience of that oneness of God, that principle of union, communion of every creature with every other creature, a profoundly humane vision. And Muhammad got it. And he got it in such a way that those around him, members of his tribe and then other tribes in the Arabian Peninsula, caught it too, a feel for the oneness of God. The word monotheism is a pale shadow of the reality we're talking about here. And that vision drew Muhammad and his followers to Jerusalem. Muhammad first suggested that he and his co-religionists would pray facing Jerusalem. Eventually that changed and they faced Mecca. But the first thing that the Muslim forces did within 5 years of the death of the prophet was approach Jerusalem. They surrounded it, they conquered it, and it's important to emphasize that they conquered it without violence. And they understood themselves in Jerusalem as a people of reconciliation, and they literally brought about a reconciliation between Jews and Christians. First time Jews had been welcomed back into the city, and under the rule of Muslims, Jews and Christians continued to live in Jerusalem ever since, really. And they controlled the city for more than 1,000 years, with a brief period during the Crusades when they lost it to the Latin Christians. But Muslims never had that Jewish and Christian experience of having to long for the lost city, well, until our own time, which is part of what accounts for the fierce Palestinian attachment to the land that they lost in 1948 and 1967. So these themes are common to all three people, even if experienced somewhat differently.
You've described the imaginary place and the sense of loss and the hope for a triumphant or messianic return. Now describe the actual city, the numbers of the kinds of people that are living there, the number of languages, the secular components and relics.
Yes, Jerusalem today is a profoundly divided city at one level. I mean, there are, you might say, among the Israelis, there's a multiplicity of Jewish identities, Russian immigrants, Ethiopians, Sephardic Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, secular Jews, ultra-Orthodox, very religious Jews, all one way or another in contention with each other over what it is to be a true Jew. There are Arabs who hold Israeli passports. There are Palestinians who are at the mercy of Israeli occupation in the West Bank and in Gaza. There are Christians, an increasing minority, a dwindling minority. But even among the Christians, there's contention. The Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, Latin Christians, Franciscans, Armenians, with contention among them as well. One of the striking notes about Jerusalem are its contentions. But the more striking is the way in which this city has found it possible down through the millennia again to live in tension with these various conflicts. And you see that today. The most palpable symbol of contention in Jerusalem right now, of course, is the so-called security barrier that divides Palestinian areas from Jewish areas, cutting through Jerusalem and going right along the border of the West Bank.
Do both the Jews and the Arabs lay claim to the whole of the city of Jerusalem?
No, they don't. In fact, there is a consensus on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian divide that the city is to be shared. The definition of that sharing is what is still at issue. But no, all but the most extreme fringes of the religious fanatical edge of ultra-Orthodox Judaism acknowledges the integrity of the Islamic shrine on the so-called noble sanctuary, what Jews call the Temple Mount, in the very heart of Old Jerusalem, the so-called sacred basin. And there's a consensus on both sides. Polls show this, that Palestinians and Muslims will have to, whatever the accommodation is, have to exercise some kind of sovereignty over that place. And the rest of East Jerusalem and how it will be shaped as a capital of the Palestinian state, here's hoping it comes to that, is to be negotiated. But it's very clear already, and one sees this even in the rhetoric at the most heated level, that this is a city, and I prefer the word shared to divided, that must be shared. It doesn't necessarily need to be divided. There can be formula, there are formula, for agreed upon ways of sharing sovereignty over the so-called sacred basin in the very heart of the city, to which Christians, Jews, and Muslims all have a serious claim.
But you also say there have been something like 60 proposed political solutions to the conflict over the last 100 years, and to this point without result.
It's true, but let me amend that by saying that to this point without result, but referring to what I said a moment ago, there has been a successful coming to a conclusion of what the end result must look like in terms of the so-called two-state solution. It's far from inevitable that that will come about, but it's too soon also to abandon hope for it. And if there is a two-state solution, its broad definitions are already well known to both sides, whether you refer to the so-called Clinton parameters or the agreements that other parties have come to, including notably the Abbas Barak negotiations that took place not long ago. So the present situation is fluid. The revolutions in the streets of Arab nations is a new factor. And the will of the Obama administration to exercise more powerful influence toward a two-state solution, these are all up in the air. The present moment is a moment of grim confrontation with the Israeli government yet again authorizing the expansion of settlements, which is a self-defeating move. The situation is still fluid. And let me just make one quick and further point. There are three parties to this conflict, not just Israelis and Palestinians. The third, mostly unnamed party, is this long history belonging to Western civilization that includes both anti-Semitism and racist European colonialism, which has really crippled the possibility of the people on the ground to bring about a quick and prompt solution. So we all have a stake in this, and my really fierce hope, and I don't believe it's only unrealistic, is that a resolution in Jerusalem will have great resonance for the whole world.
Along that same line, you also say that Jerusalem is the main point of focus of Western civilization, more so than Athens or Rome or Paris or London, and that it is the mainstream of Western civilization. And therefore, if change is going to come about, it has to be within a reformulation of the what we mean by Western civilization.
It's true, and I can imagine your listeners not kind of visually disagreeing with me when I make such a broad claim for Jerusalem, but you use the phrase the mainstream. Yes, but I would compare it to the Gulf Stream, that current of overheated water that runs below the surface of the otherwise frigid Atlantic Ocean. Jerusalem is like the Gulf Stream running below the surface of the ocean of Western civilization. Often we're not consciously aware of it, and yet it influences everything. It influences the life of the sea. It influences the climate of the various places where the Gulf Stream comes to the shore. And every once in a while it breaks to the surface, bubbling hot geysers, and we see it. But mostly we don't. Nevertheless, it's there. In the United States of America, one of the surprises I came to is the discovery that the most common place name for cities, towns, and villages in this country, if you include Jerusalem, Zion, and Salem, they're place names for this one city. Jerusalem lives deep in our unconscious, and therefore the conscious problem of Jerusalem has all the more weight for us, which is why we attend to it.
You also say that the solution or the possible resolution of the conflict requires some kind of dealing with the, what you said at the beginning of the program was the bipartisan polarity in Western thought between good and evil.
Well, it's true. It was in Jerusalem that certainly that Christians first came to this ready definition of the world as divided between the good and the evil. And Christians all too often have taken for granted that they're on the side of good and have wrecked, therefore, in the name of God, much evil. Jerusalem lives on as a center of that kind of bipolarity.
And you also say that the solution is to get rid of the division between religious and secular, political and religious, and to somehow reformulate the oneness of the religious idea. And you talk about good religion and bad religion. Maybe you can say a few words about what is the good religion that may be.
Well, it's true. And even while decrying the bipolar imagination, I think we can make distinctions within the convictions we have. So religion, I don't believe that religion is the problem. That's one of the most common charges we hear today, that if we could just get rid of religion, we would get rid of so much of the violence in the world, as if religion is the main cause of it, which has been a kind of a post-Enlightenment charge. My strong conviction is that religion is part of the human condition. Not all people are religious, but it is human to be religious, and the billions of people who are religious need to be encouraged to think critically about their religious ideas. So good religion for me is essentially religion that is capable of self-criticism, religion that is capable of measuring the impact of theology and ideology on behavior in the real world. What does our belief lead us to do in relationship to the neighbor? And if our beliefs lead us to be violent toward the neighbor, we have to re-examine our beliefs. An example of this clear is the Christian world's reckoning with the tradition of anti-Judaism, which spawned anti-Semitism, and uprooting the sources of anti-Judaism in Christianity is a good example of changing belief because of reckoning with how terrible its consequences to human beings was. So good religion is above all self-critical. It has an historical point of view. It understands itself as having evolved over time.
And you say that that good religion, the humane notion of religion, is embodied in one of the founding stories of Jerusalem, which is the possible sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham.
It's true. The Abraham-Isaac story is foundational not just for the three monotheistic traditions, but for our culture. It tells the story of a man who was ordered by God, as he understood it, to go to the mountaintop in Jerusalem, as the tradition says, and put on the altar there his only beloved son, Isaac, and kill Isaac as an offering to God. And at the last moment, as he's wielding the knife, an angel stops him and God commands him not to kill Isaac, and Isaac is taken from the altar and replaced there by a ram, which is provided miraculously in a nearby thicket in the bush. The story in Genesis obviously is a story that this God, the God that this people worships, does not will human sacrifice, does not will killing in the name of God. The Abraham-Isaac story is a profound, humane foundation for the biblical tradition that comes from it. And the relevance of that story, of course, is that fathers and mothers are continually putting their sons and daughters on the altar of sacrifice. Wilfred Owen wrote a magnificent and powerful poem just a week before he was killed on the Western Front in World War I, called The Parable of the Old Man and the Young, in which he said that the fathers of Europe had reversed the story of Abraham and Isaac, slew all of the seed of Europe, as the poem ends, one by one. It's a very contemporary problem, in other words. And every time old men send young men off to war, this point of reference is being struck.
Well, on that hopeful note, James Carroll, thank you very much for speaking with us today about the history, geopolitics, and theology of Jerusalem. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.